The following reading from Harry Kunzru was recorded on Friday the 20th of June 2014 at Birkbeck, University of London. It accompanies a conversation with the author which explores his work in some detail and is available to download on the Pod Academy website. By way of an introduction to this, here he reads from two of his books, Gods Without Men and Memory Palace.
Gods Without Men is a novel that is at least partly about what's sort of in, not just what's not on the page, but what's kind of in between the various narratives that I've sort of collaged together in this book. I wanted to write something in a way that a lot of the main events took place in silence, or took place kind of at things that were kind of not quite narratable. I'm very interested in fragments, very interested in trying to speak about that which cannot be spoken about in some way. So that seemed to be a formal way of approaching that. One of the stories that sort of runs through the book is about an Indian American, as opposed to an American Indian, who a guy called Jazz, who goes to work for a hedge fund, and which is doing a kind of trading that's based on a computer model. So his boss has made a computer model that he has called Walter. I'll read a little bit about Jazz and this guy Cy Bachman discussing the implications of this trading model that Bachman has built. When Jazz presented himself at Bachman's office the following day, he expected to be shown some kind of formula. The Walter setup was very cloak and dagger, a separate address, pin codes and biometrics to get through the door. Bachman had a view of the Hudson and a display case full of curios behind his desk that Jazz avoided scrutinising too closely in case it led to a conversation about basketry or ceramics or netsuke, topics which would quickly lead him out of his comfort zone. Luckily, Bachman got straight to business. He told him the best way to understand the model was to work with it, which seemed sensible enough. When Jazz asked about its basic principles, he waved the question away. Bachman's model was conventional in that it relied on discovering certain predictable behaviours in the market, regularities, trackable cycles, and using that knowledge to trade. But as far as Jazz could grasp from the initial presentation, which took almost 3 hours and left him feeling like he'd been sparring with some kind of higher dimensional gorilla, the type of regularities Walter sought were particularly fleeting and unstable. The model was being trained not simply to exploit some temporary price disparity, but to identify and track entirely ad hoc constellations of 5, 6, 7 variables, brief but dazzling phenomena, lightning flashes of correlation. The math, Jazz thought, was some of the most beautiful he'd ever encountered. The problem that would come to tug at him like an importunate child was something else, something about Walter's responsiveness, his voracious thirst for data. It was more like an organism than a computer program. It felt alive. For the first few months, he had little to do with Walter's guts, the software that identified patterns and executed trades. His job was to take certain data sets and hunt for statistical relationships, what Bachman called rhymes. The material, prepared according to some arcane process Bachman refused to discuss, came in discrete clusters, little clots of seemingly unrelated numbers. Some of it was familiar: commodity and share prices, government bond yields, interest rates, currency fluctuations. There was other data on shopping mall construction, retail sales figures, drug patent applications, car ownership, on the incidence of birth defects, industrial injuries, suicides, controlled substance seizures, cell phone tower construction. Walter consumed the most esoteric numbers: small arms sales in the Horn of Africa, the population of Gary, Indiana between 1940 and 2008, the population of Magnitogorsk, Siberia for the same years, prostitution arrests across major American cities, data traffic over the TPE Trans-Pacific Cable, the height of the water table in various subregions of the Maghreb. Some of the data was so bizarre that Jazz couldn't help but feel Willis's quip about a theory of everything was close to the mark. It was as if Bachman were trying to fit the whole world into his model. What was external to Walter? Was there anything it didn't aim to comprehend? When Jazz tried hesitantly to frame this question, Cy launched into a convoluted monologue, at the end of which things were no clearer than before. Walter, he said, pacing his office like a prisoner exercising in his cell, didn't rely on the opposition between external and internal. It wasn't some tin toy simplification of the world which chose a few variables and ignored the rest. Conversely, it didn't need to know the state of everything at some initial time T in order to find the patterns it sought. Walter worked in a different way. "It's like plunging your hands into a river," he said, "and pulling out a fish." Despite Jazz's scepticism, he soon had to admit that there were rhymes, and they existed in the weirdest places. One day he found a periodic cycle in a cluster of figures for CPU transistor counts since 1960, IQ test scores for African-American boys from single-parent families, and an epidemiological analysis of the spread of the methamphetamine drug Yaba through Thailand and Southeast Asia. Not only was there a strange harmony to the movements of this grab bag of statistics, but it seemed to track a certain popular measure of volatility in currency markets. He checked and rechecked the figures. He hadn't miscalculated. Filled with an odd sense of foreboding, he presented his findings to Bachon, who nodded appreciatively. "Perfect," he said. "I told Fenton you had the knack for this. I wasn't wrong." Jazz spoke carefully, not sure where his words would lead him. "I'm not sure I understand, Si. Surely this is a meaningless coincidence. There's no link between any of these things." Bachman's hands fluttered to his neck, checking the perfect Windsor knot of his tie. He swiveled his chair toward the window and looked out at the river, a dull grey band between the sleek black faces of the towers. It was early February, and rain was smeared against the glass, the outside world a barely recognisable blur. "Get your coat. I want to show you something." They took Bachman's car uptown through heavy lunch hour traffic. Bachman fiddled with his cufflinks, idly leafing through a stack of reports. Jazz sent texts, half aware of the rubber-booted pedestrians swarming the crosswalks, wrestling their umbrellas into the wind. It was a bad day to be selling gyros or hailing a cab. Trucks ploughed furrows through curbside puddles, sending waves of dirty water arcing into the air. Office workers scurried for cover. Die-hard smokers jostled for position in sheltered doorways. Any heavier and there'd be kayaks, people clinging to floating wreckage. The driver let them out at a townhouse in the East 80s facing the park. A discreet plaque announced the place as the Neue Gallery, a museum Lisa had talked about. But Jazz had never been inside. Bachman appeared to be known to the staff. The security guard greeted him by name as he waved them in. They climbed the stairs and entered a room hung with paintings. Bachman steered him past a flashy Klimt ringed by tourists, towards a vitrine containing various small decorative objects, clocks, glassware, and jewellery. Like a waiter gesturing at a particularly good corner table, he extended his hand toward a silver coffee set, sleek and plain and scientific-looking, pots and jugs with big geometric handles and rows of studs around their bases, arranged on a little tray, complete with a set of tongs and a spirit burner to keep the coffee warm. "Do you enjoy the Wiener Werkstätte?" Jazz would probably have used the word depot to describe the things in the case. Bachman frowned, picking up on his discomfort. "I'm sorry, I didn't bring you here to lecture you about art history. This was made in Vienna, just before World War I, by a man called Hoffmann, a very brilliant man, an architect and furniture designer. Founded a sort of Viennese arts and crafts movement. I don't know why I find it so moving. It's such an unserious thing. What a lot of effort and skill to lavish on something as ordinary as making coffee. And when you think about when it was made..." He trailed off, staring gloomily into the case. After a moment, he shook his head in the abrupt manner of a sleeper trying to wake himself up. Jazz realised he knew precisely nothing about Si Bachman, about how he thought, the things he loved. He had a sudden image of a man for whom the present day was no more than a thin crust of ice over a deep, cold lake. Disturbed, he turned around, pretending to examine a painting on the wall behind him. Bachman touched his arm, gently repositioning him in front of Hoffman's coffee set. He spoke under his breath as though imparting a secret. "When I come here, I always find myself wondering what happened to the people who owned this. I feel they must have been Jews, wealthy Viennese Jews. How long did they survive? First their country vanishes, then the Anschluss, the deportations. How many years could the family maintain a life that included such luxuries?" He sighed deeply. Jazz wondered if he expected a reply. "Have you ever been to Vienna, Jazz?" "No, I haven't." It's a very unsettling city, at least I find it so. The main cemetery is vast. They say it has a larger population of the dead than the city has living. All very well kept, very neat, until you come to the Jewish section, which has been completely neglected. There's no one left, you see. No relatives, no descendants to tend the graves. All those families with their possessions and their big houses and their servants and their taste all vanished, ashes floating out of a crematorium chimney. He went on, speaking urgently now, gripping Jazz's arm with one hand and describing little arcs and circles with the other, like a concert goer following a score. As with most art, this is an attempt to stand outside time. That's perhaps its most luxurious quality. One could even say a sign of decadence. What a moment to deny history, when it was about to trample over everything. Not just the ritual of coffee and cake, but everything, the whole culture. There's a tradition that says the world has shattered, that what once was whole and beautiful is now just scattered fragments. Much is it irreparable, but a few of these fragments contain faint traces of the former state of things, and if you find them and uncover the sparks hidden inside, perhaps at last you'll piece together the fallen world. This is just a glass case of wreckage, but it has presence. It's redemptive. It's part of something larger than itself. I see. No, I don't think you do. Not yet. What if one were to want to hunt for these hidden presences? You can't just rummage about like you're at a yard sale. You have to listen. You have to pay attention. There are certain things you can't look at directly. You need to trick them into revealing themselves. And that's what we're doing with Walter. We're juxtaposing things, listening for echoes. It's not just some silly cybernetic dream of command and control, modelling the whole world so you can predict the outcome. It's certainly not a theory of everything. I don't have a theory of any kind. What I have is far more profound. What's that? A sense of humour. Jazz looked at him, trying to find a clue in his gaunt face, in the clear grey eyes watching him with such, what, amusement? Condescension? There was something about the man which brought on a sort of hermeneutic despair. He was a forest of signs. We're hunting for jokes. Bachman spoke slowly, as if to a child. Parapraxis. Cosmic slips of the tongue. They're the key to the locked door. They'll help us discover it. Discover what? The face of God. What else would we be looking for? So that's Cy Bachman and his trading model. And those ideas about memory and fragments do link to the Memory Palace project, which was an exhibition at the V&A, but is a text which stands up reasonably well on its own. So yeah, I'll read a little bit from the beginning of that and then we can have a conversation. Here's how to remember. First, you must choose a place. It should be somewhere you know very well. Most people pick somewhere spacious and grand, a great hall, one of the ruined towers of the city. You get to know this place as well as you can. You walk around it, impressing every detail on your memory, until you can tour it in your mind when you're not there. Then you place the things you need to remember around the building in the form of pictures. These pictures must be startling enough to trigger your imagination. They can be the faces of people you know, or common things combined or altered in an unusual way. A man with the head of a fox, a waterfall flowing uphill. If there's a list of facts you need to remember, you can put them in some specific order. In this way, when you need to recall something, you merely go in your imagination to the spot where you've stored it. There it will be, waiting for you. When I learned the art of memory, I was living in an old palace in Great Portland Street. Before the withering, it had been a library, every room filled with pewter and sign. I knew each corner of that house without having to make an effort, so it was easy to use it to remember by. Later, after I was arrested and confined in this cell, I was afraid I would go mad, so small was it. So featureless and dark. I cried in the night. When I slept, I dreamed I was being crushed. So I began to move my memories, to place them round the cell, in the cracks of the floor, on the rusty handle of the slop bucket. By rights, such a small room could not serve the purpose, but I gave each spot a meaning, and as I populated it with the things I had been given to remember, the cell began to grow. It was like pushing the walls outwards with my hands. Now, It has expanded to the horizon. To me, it is as grand as a power station. I have been charged with membership of an internet. There's been no trial, just a meeting of the thanes in the great hall of the London Thing. But they use these words, charged, internet. They don't really know what they mean anymore. They're words from before the withering. They use the words out of vanity, mostly. The men who gather to question me have no more notion of information age laws than they do of physics or evolution. But they're terribly insecure and terribly righteous. They are to be the bringers of the wilding, the ones who will make the world anew. They are the swaggering lords of the red and the white and the green. Ignorance is only purity tarnished by scorn. That's the slogan. Knowing nothing should be cherished. It's a sign that you're free of trace. Secretly, they're not sure, these great lords. They have doubts, alone in their chambers at night. They feel the chill hand of death tapping on their shoulder. So when they puff out their chests and bring down their thunder on the likes of me, they cloak it in old-time words, because those words have power, such thunder as they can muster. In their bones, the lords of the Thing know they are small men compared to the sign-wielders, the builders of hospitals. However much they exalt themselves, they know. The shadows of the ruined towers fall on them as they walk through the city, just as they do on the rest of us. People have different visions of the end, but all agree it is coming. The wilding might be a joyful harmonizing with nature. It might feel like throwing down a heavy burden, straightening upright after being weighed down by civilization over so many centuries. Or it might just be nothingness, our exit as a species from the world stage. Something that would be a blessing. They're hastening to bring it about. After what our ancestors did, we don't deserve to strut around like masters of the earth. We should be ashamed, hang our heads. Without us crawling on her back, the great mother would breathe more freely. And I'll leave it there.
That was Harry Kunzru reading from Gods Without Men and then Memory Palace. For the accompanying podcast, which includes an extensive discussion with the author, go to podacademy.org.